Our next case this morning is number 03-3161 and 3165, Brokaw against Mercer County, Illinois. Ms. Moran.
May it please the court, my name is Molly Moran, amicus on behalf of A.D. Brokaw. A.D., a pro se plaintiff below, was before this court 2 years ago trying to reverse the sua sponte dismissal of her claims, which arise from her removal from her home in 1983 at the age of three. On remand, this court noted its serious concerns with the fairness and integrity of the state proceedings that are at the heart of A.D. Brokaw's claims. Despite the serious nature of her claims, within 10 months of remand, the district court dismissed AD's claims on the basis that she had missed one hearing and that she had not signed consent forms to release her juvenile records, consent forms that she had not drafted, that she had not had an opportunity to review, and had not had an opportunity to comment on.
Maybe you can help me understand this a little bit. I certainly followed the arguments that both sides were making. But there's an Alice in Wonderland quality to me about these consent forms with the juvenile records, since everybody seems to have had them for years. What in the world is really going on with these things?
Well, much of the history is happened in a case that AD was not part of.
Well, I know it, but the forms themselves, right? I mean, that was part of the objection before this court, and other people were attaching them, and so on and so forth. Why has this blown up into such a big issue?
Well, speaking on AD's behalf, the records themselves are sensitive records that reflect psychological evaluations of her when she was a child, and they have been disclosed. And in fact, they're not under seal, and they are part of this record, which is a great concern to her. The parties, however, it appears from the record that the defendants, although some of them have had an opportunity to review those records, or were at least were in possession of the records, do not want to act on those records until AD and her brother consent to their review. So although the records are in fact known, they are filed in open court, and some of the defendants have had them in their possession, there is the notion that they shouldn't be used for discovery purposes until the subjects have in fact agreed to their release and to their use. The magistrate's report and recommendation makes it plain that AD is being held accountable for actions that were taken in her brother's case, a separate case, long before consolidation. AD's conduct alone and in isolation, that of her brother, does not support the conclusion that she engaged in a pattern of willful disobedience of the court's orders, or that she acted in bad faith sufficient to merit the ultimate sanction of dismissal. The record that existed at the time that the magistrate recommended dismissal was as follows. AD had missed one hearing, April 3rd, a hearing that all agree she did not receive notice of.
Was she represented by counsel then?
She was not. She was a pro se plaintiff. Two orders were issued directing that she sign the consent forms. Those orders were entered, one dated January 31st, the other dated April 4th. And she did not have an opportunity to review the consents or even have an opportunity to discuss the issue with the court prior to the orders being entered. She received the first order, which was dated January 31st, on April 3rd. And she happened to receive that order on the day of the status hearing, but after the status hearing had occurred, and she missed that status hearing because she did not receive a copy of the order.
Was this while she was in California?
Yes. She's AD resides in California at this time. And during the relevant time of these events, prior to the status, she and upon receipt of the two orders that directed her to sign the consent forms, AD drafted objections, which she objected to the manner in which the consent forms were prepared, and she also asked and requested that she be allowed to draft her own consent forms. She mailed her objections and then appeared at the April 21st status hearing, which was the first opportunity that she had to address the issue with the court. During that status hearing, she objected to her to the manner in which the consent forms were prepared. She also objected to signing the consent forms that were at that point before the court. The court took the consent form issue under advisement and the next day received her objections, which requested that she be allowed to sign and prepare consent forms on her own behalf. And then she waited. She waited for the court to rule. I see my time is coming close. The next step is that the magistrate judge issued his report and recommendation. He denied her request to write her own consent forms, and then he also dismissed the case, citing a history of refusal to sign consent forms. On this record alone, that is not sufficient from AD's perspective to merit dismissal. She has not shown a pattern of willful disobedience of the court's orders. The lower court should have considered a lesser sanction, particularly since AD, a pro se litigant, has shown diligence in prosecuting her claim. She filed her lawsuit upon achieving the age of majority, and she also timely filed briefs in the lower court and this court related to the Rucker-Feldman issue. I see that my time is up.
Thank you, Ms. Moran. We'll hear now from Ms. Gunther.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Marilyn Gunther, and I'm the attorney representing C.A. Brokaw in this appeal. It's a very strange situation, and I agree with the court that it seems to have an Alice in Wonderland characterization here.
Sometimes it does, but let me, because time is so short, let me just alert you to the fact that when it comes to C.A.'s case, the history was quite different from AD's, and we do have Rule 72 about filing objections to reports and recommendations of magistrate judges, and it appears that CA did not file timely recommendations. So why have you not waived your right to appellate review?
I argued that in the brief. It is not a jurisdictional issue. On the date that the court had arbitrarily set and denied my client's motion for an extension of time as moot, we called the court and asked for permission to have it deemed timely if mailed that day. It was mailed that day. However, orally, the court denied that oral
motion. Well, that's
motion.
Right. Now, I understand it's not jurisdictional, but the fact is it's a rule in which we respect the ability of the district courts to govern their dockets, and if the district court says, I'm not going to take late filings, absent something quite extraordinary, we normally enforce those kinds of rulings.
Your Honor, if the court were to look at the objections that were filed, it was extensive. I think it was 26 pages. There were multiple issues that needed to be addressed and multiple court orders that needed to be looked at and needed to be analyzed, and the timeliness and so forth. It took far more time than the court had allowed, and the court had, as mentioned, denied as moot the motion for extension of time because I would have asked for a little bit more time than to the July 8th deadline that they set on the basis of AD's motion.
Well, basically, what the court was doing was treating the two of you the same, so it was giving you as much time as AD had. But you didn't meet that deadline. You didn't actually have your objections in until, some 10 days later or so?
Well, they were mailed on the day they were due.
But they weren't in, though, in the hands of the court until some number of days later.
That is correct, along with a motion to file in stanter.
Right, but which the court denied.
Which the court denied.
Right.
And I have addressed that issue as being an abuse of the court's discretion, because if the court looks at the clearly erroneous standard as argued by amicus counsel, they would recognize that this is a case where there should not have been a dismissal, because there was a lesser alternative, and that would be to enter the order over the objection. This is allowed by Illinois law, and there are times when I believe I'm the only attorney in this case that looked at the Illinois law. I had urged it to the court way back when we first made our response to the motions to dismiss that were granted, and then again in the objections and in the brief now. The court could easily have overcome the consent issue just by entering an order. The Illinois allows it. The case law allows it.
You mean that would overcome this idea of needing dual signatures as opposed to just CAs in your case?
There's no requirement for signatures at all if the court makes an order.
But that was the objection that CA had toward the end of not signing the consent because he couldn't sign for his sister.
No, that was what he put in April of 2002. When the court literally stayed the discovery because AD was not under the jurisdiction of that court at that time.
Well,
the discovery was stayed.
What took place on, was it April, what was the date, that the April 3rd, is that the date that they were due? Or
April 3rd of 2003.
What I'm talking about when they were mailed, when he mailed the objections.
The objections were mailed on July the 8th.
I want to get that date straight. That's the date,
that they were due. That the court had issued as
and,
the due date.
And was there a phone conversation or some other effort?
There was a Rule 6B phone conversation with Judge McDade asking permission. And once that request is put in, then it's not necessary to show excusable neglect or good cause, as I understand it, because the motion is put in prior to the expiration of the time.
And you didn't get an extension for filing?
Judge McDade apparently denied it, and apparently he did not even look at the objections that were filed. Are there any further questions? Thank you.
Apparently not. Thank you. We'll hear now from Ms. Potts.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Diane Potts, Assistant Attorney General. With me at counsel table are William Rector and Barbara Collins on behalf of the defendants. The defendants asked this Court to affirm the lower court's decision on two grounds. First, because both plaintiffs failed to file specific objections to the magistrate judge's report and recommendation, they've waived appeal review of that decision. And second, even if the plaintiffs have not waived review of the dismissal, the district court did not abuse its discretion in dismissing the plaintiff's case, either as a discovery sanction or for failure to prosecute.
Ms. Potts, can I say it would be helpful for me anyway if you addressed each of the plaintiffs separately, because I'm concerned, particularly language in the magistrate judge's report and recommendation, with what appears to be the assumption that once there's been a Rule 42A consolidation of cases, somehow the plaintiffs become fungible. And that's not what a consolidation does. They're still separate cases, and the parties are separate parties. It's not like a class action where one is all of a sudden representing the other and bound by what the other does. And it seems that a lot of the behavior of CA is attributed to AD.
That is not the case, Your Honor. If you look at AD's conduct in isolation without regard to CA's conduct, she engaged in there's clear record of willful delays.
Well,
and
what's
continuous
the willful delay? She responds within the 30 days that she's given to furnish her current address. Then the court sits on things for nearly a month, waiting from February 27th until the end of March to send out the order, literally a month. I think it's March 27th. Then everything unfolds very quickly. You know, the hearing mm-hmm. happens on April 3rd. Sometimes, unfortunately, the U.S. mail doesn't make it from Illinois out to California in that number of days. I just don't see what the pattern is. She files objections, and I gather this is really all about what sorts of restrictions and sealing and the like will happen vis-a-vis these juvenile records.
Your Honor, to address, the reason that A.D. Brokaw did not have an opportunity to litigate the issue of whether or not she should have to consent to these juvenile court records is because she failed to give the court her address. She knew she won her appeal in September of 2002. She knew the mandate issued in 2002, and she knew that this court specifically directed the district court to consider consolidating cases.
But we're talking about the difference. October 8th, 2002 is this court's order remanding AD's case to the district court. And by January, people are getting in touch with her. Frankly, in the real world, that doesn't strike me as a contumaciously long period of time. It's a bit long. It's not instantaneous. But as a pro se litigant, it's not clear to me that she should have been more on the ball than she was.
But, Your Honor, the defendants filed a motion to compel her consent to the disclosures in October, immediately following the issuing of the mandate.
But she didn't get it. Right? No, it's October the 17th is the consolidation motion and the consent request. But she, you know, again, I mean, what you're saying is she waited until she heard about things, and she did comply with the court's January 28th order. I mean,
Eve of dismissal, she did.
Well, it doesn't matter. How many lawyers do you know who wait until the last day?
Yes, Your Honor.
I don't take that as
Your Honor.
Too out of the ordinary.
The magistrate judge specifically found that her not being notified of what was going on in the 5 months was entirely her fault, and that finding of fact has to be reviewed for clear error. But even after she resurfaced, after 5 months, she missed the April 3rd hearing.
You agree she hadn't heard about it.
She hadn't heard about it.
Because the clerk didn't send the notice of the January 31 order until March 27.
Correct, Your Honor. But that January 31st order...
So why does that make her contumacious?
Well, the January 31st order expressly informed her, one, that there was an order entered that she consent to the records, and two...
But you're not answering my question, though. If you agree... I mean, if you're going to blame her for not knowing about the January 31st order because of what was happening in October, that's fine. I mean, I understand that argument. But if we're going to say the court decided 3 days before that, on January 28th, to give her a window of 30 days, and then to turn around and punish her for not getting the January 31st order until after the clerk sent it to her, it's a little contradictory.
Even if you were to take her actions from April 4th on, we know she received two orders, a January 31st order and an April 4th order, saying that she must execute this consent or face dismissal of her lawsuit. She has never put any justification for her refusal to consent to execute that consent. And her lawsuit has placed these juvenile court records at issue. I mean, they're the heart of this case. And the district court specifically ruled that the defendants could not use these records for purposes of discovery unless and until the plaintiffs issued those consents.
But as I understand it, this isn't an all or nothing debate that's going on. This is more in the nature of how much of a protective order will be in place. So I don't understand from what either CA or AD has filed that anyone's saying the order that these records can't be used. This is all some sort of bizarre debate about restrictions.
The district court's prior to AD case being consolidated with AD, the district court was very clear with the defendants that in order to use these records for purposes of discovery, the consents had to be in, and that's why the district court actually stayed at the proceedings, mm-hmm. waiting for mm-hmm. AD to come back to come and consolidate the cases. Not only did she fail to willfully disobey the court's order to execute the consent without justification, she called the court inept. And as I is argued in the brief, she waived any issue with regard to the magistrate judge's report and recommendation dismissing her case, because all she filed two documents. One said that there were misleading, incorrect statements in that report and recommendation, and the other didn't refer to any finding of fact or legal holding in the magistrate judge's report and recommendation. Under this court's decision in the Lockhart case, she has waived review of that report and recommendation dismissing her lawsuit. If this court were to say that what she filed was sufficient, it would depreciate the waiver rule completely, and it wouldn't further the purposes of an objection. The objection is there to point the district court to what in particular the losing litigant has found offensive, and she has done no more than say, I object, it's wrong, and there's some misleading and false statements in there. It's no different than if someone were to file an appeal in this court and merely tell you, I appeal. And would this court then be required to review the case for clear error? The principles are the same. It's judicial efficiency. Why should the district court have to review an entire record and file and decision when the parties themselves have not identified and specified what in particular they have found offensive or wrong with the report and recommendation? So that is our first argument, Your Honor, that CA waived his right to review in this court for failing to file any objections. AD has waived review because she has not filed specific objections as required in the Lockhart case. And if you look at the Lockhart case, that was actually more specific than what she filed. Again, if you were to allow a litigant to merely say, I object, and that were to suffice, you would create a perverse incentive for litigants to do exactly that, because then they would be able to have review of the entire proceeding, and the hapless litigant that actually follows Rule 72B and actually files specific objections gets review of only that issue and foregoes review of everything else.
A better analogy might be, though, an appeal to this court from someone who says, I was excluded from my trial, and I'm trying to get the transcript so that I can find out what happened to me. Now, if you were there, then of course you have an obligation to specify what it is the district court did wrong and why you've objected. But if you look at least AD's complaints, and I'm separating CA, who's in a different position here, but hers are in the nature of, I want the transcript from the April 3rd thing that I never knew about. I need some specificity so that I can meet this standard you're talking about.
The analogy to missing a trial is not accurate. And the reason is what the district court, what the magistrate judge was asking her to do was very simple. And she refused without justification. There was nothing that went on during that April 3rd hearing that would have made any difference.
Well, you know that, but I guess she doesn't.
Okay.
Maybe she knows now.
Thank you, Your Honor. For all these reasons, we'd ask this court affirm as to the dismissal of both plaintiffs' lawsuits.
Thank you, Ms. Potts. You have 1 minute for rebuttal.
AD did not waive appellate review. She specified her objections to the history, the procedural history of the events that occurred related to the consent forms. She specified her objections to put the court on notice of the issue that she wanted the court to review. This is all that is required under the Johnson and the standard expressed by this court in the Johnson case. AD asks only for the opportunity to address the serious concerns that this court identified with the underlying state proceedings from which her claims arise. To date, the district court has denied her that opportunity. She asks that this court respectfully find that the district court abused its discretion and reverse this case for further proceedings. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Our thanks to all counsel in the case. And Ms. Moran, you appeared via appointment of the court, and you have the thanks of the court for having taken on this assignment, and indeed your law firm has the thanks of the court for having helped us in this regard. The case will be taken under advisement.